Before 2003, Buffett's need for attention had been satisfied by a few interviews a year and the shareholder meeting. He had always been careful and strategic in his cooperation with the media, if not always forthcoming about just how cooperative he had been. But starting around the time of Susie's illness, for whatever reason, he had begun to need the mirror of media attention, television cameras especially, almost like a drug. The intervals he could tolerate without publicity were growing shorter. He cooperated with documentaries, spent hours talking to Charlie Rose, and became such a regular on CNBC that it started to prompt puzzled queries from his friends. The Buffett who so craved attention contrasted markedly with the Buffett who focused with unaltered intensity on Berkshire Hathaway. To see him flip from one mode into the other in half a second was head-spinning. In addition to adding Bill Gates to the board, he now set up a whistleblower line so that employees could report wrongdoing. And, in a major step toward the day when Berkshire's board would have to make decisions without him, he initiated separate meetings of the board without his presence. Yet he remained as focused on investing as he had been as a younger man. Since the Federal Reserve's dramatic interest rate cuts in the wake of 9/11, the market had steadily recouped its losses until it was nearing bubble-era levels. Buffett wrote in his 2004 letters to shareholders, "My hope was to make several multi-billion-dollar acquisitions that would add new and significant streams of earnings to the many we already have. But I struck out. Additionally, I found very few attractive securities to buy. Berkshire therefore ended the year with $43 billion of cash equivalents, not a happy position." The following year, Berkshire used part of this money to make four small acquisitions: Medical Protective Company and Applied Underwriters, two insurance businesses, Forest River, a recreational vehicle manufacturer, and Business Wire, which distributed public relations material for corporations, and one larger acquisition, Pacific Corp, a major electric utility, for MidAmerican Energy. While MidAmerican had not yet spawned a huge series of acquisitions as Buffett had hoped, the wisdom of buying it had grown clearer. Oil prices had continued to rise. MidAmerican had a significant toehold in alternative energy. Its relationships with consumers and regulators were excellent. Its CEO, David Sokol, was often mentioned as a potential successor to Buffett, although Buffett himself was keeping his cards very close to the vest. Buffett also used this report to reiterate that he was still down on the dollar and thought it would decline. The dollar had strengthened since his first article, and now his view was being widely criticized in the financial press. He had reduced his currency bets in favor of buying foreign stocks, but nothing changed his view. And once again, he decried excessive executive compensation. On derivatives, a topic he now covered every year, Buffett wrote, "Long ago, Mark Twain said, 'A man who tries to carry a cat home by its tail will learn a lesson that can be learned in no other way.' I dwell on our experiences in derivatives each year for two reasons. One is personal and unpleasant. Both Charlie and I knew at the time of the Gen Re purchase that it was a problem and told its management that we wanted to exit the business. It was my responsibility to make sure that happened. Rather than address the situation head-on, however, I wasted several years while we attempted to sell the operation. That was a doomed endeavor, because no realistic solution could have extracted us from the maze of liabilities that was going to exist for decades. Our obligations were particularly worrisome because their potential to explode could not be measured. Moreover, if severe trouble occurred, we knew it was likely to correlate with problems elsewhere in financial markets. So I failed in my attempt to exit painlessly, and in the meantime, more trades were put on the books." Buffett was referring to a period during which he had hired a new manager and briefly allowed him to expand the business. Some of these trades later proved costly to unwind. "Fault me for dithering. Charlie calls it thumb-sucking. When a problem exists, whether in personnel or in business operations, the time to act is now." The second reason I regularly describe our problems in this area lies in the hope that our experiences may prove instructive for managers, auditors, and regulators. In a sense, we are a canary in this business coal mine and should sing a song of warning as we expire. General Re was a relatively minor operator in the derivatives field. It has had the good sense to unwind its supposedly liquid positions in a benign market, all the while free of financial or other pressures that might have forced it to conduct the liquidation in a less than efficient manner. Our accounting in the past was conventional and thought to be conservative. Additionally, we know of no bad behavior by anyone involved. It could be a different story for others in the future. Imagine, if you will, one or more firms, troubles often spread, with positions that are many multiples of ours attempting to liquidate in chaotic markets and under extreme and well-publicized pressures. The time to have considered and improved the reliability of New Orleans levees was before Hurricane Katrina. The general belief, however, continued to be that derivatives spread and reduced risk. In a market shoved upward by cheap debt and derivatives nearly day by day, low interest rates and the securitization of mortgages into derivatives were pumping a housing boom that would peak in 2006. By one estimate, total global leverage, debt, had quadrupled in less than a decade. Buffett fretted occasionally that he might never again see the kind of home-run climate for investing that had blessed him in the 1970s, but he never stopped searching. He never stopped delving for ideas. One day in 2004, he obtained from his broker a thick book, the size of several telephone directories stapled together. Its pages contained listings of Korean stocks. He had been scouring the global economy, looking for a country, a market, that was overlooked and undervalued. He had found it in Korea. Night after night he leafed through the tome, studying column after column of numbers, page by page by page. But the numbers and their nomenclature puzzled him. He realized that he needed to learn a whole new language of business that described a different culture of commerce. So he got another book and figured out everything important there was to know about Korean accounting. That would reduce the odds of getting hornswoggled by the numbers. Once he'd mastered the listings, he began sifting and sorting. It felt something like the old days back at Graham Newman, when he sat next to the ticker machine clad in his cherished gray cotton jacket. Staring at hundreds of pages of numbers, he could pick out which were important and how they fell into a coherent pattern. Working from a list of several thousand Korean stocks, he quickly pared it down to a workable number. After making some notes on a yellow legal pad, he kept going, just as he had when he'd paged through the Moody's manual, looking for the gems amid the dreck, until finally he arrived at a much shorter list. The winnowed down list was so short that it could be contained on a single piece of legal-sized paper. Sitting down with a visitor, he held out the list, which consisted of at most a couple of dozen companies. A few were large, among the largest in the world, but most were very small. "Look it," he said. "This is how I do it. They are quoted in won. If you go to the Internet and look them up on the Korean Stock Exchange, they have numbers instead of ticker symbols, and they all end in zero, unless it's a preferred stock, in which case you click in 5. If they have a second class of preferred, you don't click in 6, you click in 7. Every night you can go to the Internet at a certain time and look up some issues, and it'll show you the 5 brokerage firms that would have been the largest buyers and the 5 that would have been the largest sellers that day. You have to set up a special account with a bank in Korea. That's not easy to do. I'm learning it as I go along. It's like finding a new girl to me. These are good companies, and yet they're cheap. The stocks have gotten cheaper than 5 years ago, and yet the businesses are more valuable. Half of the companies have names that sound like a porno movie. They make basic products like steel and cement and flour and electricity, which people will still be buying in 10 years. They have a big market share in Korea, which isn't going to change, and some of these companies are exporting to China and Japan, too. Yet for some reason they haven't been noticed. Look, this flour company has more than its market value in cash, and it sells at 3 times earnings. I couldn't buy very much, but I got a few shares. Here's another one, a dairy. I could end up with nothing but a bunch of Korean securities in my personal portfolio. Now, I'm no expert on foreign currencies, but I'm comfortable owning these securities denominated in the won right now. The main risk, and part of why the stocks are cheap, is North Korea. And North Korea is a real threat. If North Korea invaded South Korea, the whole world could go to hell. China, Japan, all of Asia would be drawn into a war. The consequences are almost unimaginable. North Korea is very close to having nuclear weapons. I regard it as one of the world's most dangerous countries. But I would make the bet that the rest of the world, including China and Japan, are simply not going to let the situation get to the point that North Korea makes a nuclear attack on South Korea anytime soon. When you invest, you have to take some risk. The future is always uncertain. I think a group of these stocks will do very well for several years. Some of them may not do well, but as a group, they should do very well. I could end up owning them for several years. He had found a new game, a new puzzle to figure out. He wanted more of them and kept looking for opportunities with the same eagerness he'd once shown stooping for winning tickets at the racetrack. In December 2005, in a talk at the Harvard Business School, he was asked about his hopes for the Buffett Foundation's impact on society, since it would someday become the best-funded philanthropy in the world. Buffett responded that his guess was that he was not doing society as great a favor by compounding anymore. So he was thinking more these days about giving the money away. Nobody said anything. Nobody seemed to realize that Buffett had just signaled a total shift in direction. Later in the same speech, he talked about the Gates Foundation. He admired Bill and Melinda Gates more than any other philanthropists, he said. Theirs was the most rational and best executed of any foundation policy he had ever seen. And he liked that they didn't want publicity for their philanthropy, did not want their name on any buildings. By early 2006, his thoughts had begun to crystallize. While he was pleased with the job his kids were doing with their own foundations, the sense of safety and security that Big Susie had given him was not duplicable. This emotional force operated beyond a conscious level. His decision to leave her in charge of the money had never been based on a rational or calculated assessment of her qualifications as a philanthropist. With the accretion of a decades-long relationship, he had simply built up layers of personal trust and comfort in his wife's judgment and wisdom. Now that she was gone, everything was different. He mentioned his change of heart to Tom Murphy at Murphy's daughter's wedding. Out of the blue, he told Sharon Osbourg he was going to give the money away early. But he only had an idea, not a plan. The plan, which was complicated, took months to work out in detail. The following spring, he started telling the people who were directly affected. "Brace yourself," he said when he sat down with Carol Loomis, one of the Buffett Foundation trustees. "The news was indeed stunning," she wrote. "I got lots of questions," he said about the conversations in which he made this startling announcement, "and some people had qualms about the plan initially because it was such an abrupt change from what they had been anticipating." His sisters, on the other hand, were instantly enthusiastic when they found out. "This is the best idea you've had," wrote Bertie afterward, "since you pretended to have asthma to get sent home from Fredericksburg." Doris, who knew from her Sunshine Lady Foundation how much work it was to give away even a few $1 million intelligently, thought it was a brilliant decision. On June 26, 2006, Buffett announced that he would give away 85% of his Berkshire Hathaway stock, worth $37 billion at the time, to a group of foundations over a number of years. No gift of this size had ever been made in the history of philanthropy. 5 out of every 6 shares would go to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, already the largest charity in the world, in a historic marriage of 2 fortunes for the betterment of the world. He was requiring that the money be spent as it was given, so that the foundations could not perpetuate themselves. To cushion the shock of losing the money that would someday have made their family foundation the largest in the world, Buffett divided the remaining shares, worth about $6 billion, among his children's individual foundations, each of which would receive shares worth $1 billion, and the Susan Thompson Buffett Foundation, which would receive shares worth $3 billion. None of the children had ever expected their personal foundations to reach such an enormous size, especially not while he was alive. At the date of the gift, the shares handed over in the first year's installment were worth $1.5 billion to the Gates Foundation, $50 million to each of his children's foundations, and $150 million to the Susan Thompson Buffett Foundation. Depending on Berkshire's stock price, those values could vary. As it turned out, they would increase. They would increase a lot. The man who was, at the time, the second richest person on Earth was giving away his money without leaving a trace of himself behind. He had spent all his life rolling up the snowball as if it were an extension of himself. Yet he would establish no Warren Buffett Foundation, no Buffett Hospital Wing, no college or university endowment or building with his name on it. To donate the money without naming something after himself, without controlling personally how it would be spent, to put the money in the coffers of another foundation that he had selected for its competence and efficiency, rather than creating a whole new empire, upended every convention of giving. No major donor had ever done such a thing before. "It was a historic moment in the field of philanthropy globally," said Doug Bauer of Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors. "It set a bar, a touchstone for others." That Warren Buffett had done this was both surprising and predictable. An unconventional thinker and problem solver, he was making a gesture against philanthropic waste and grandiosity. The Gates Foundation got its money, but had to spend each installment, and fast. The decision was unusual, highly personal, a form of teaching by example, and, naturally, enormously attention-getting. Meanwhile, in another sense, this was a classic Buffett no-lose deal. He had stunned the world by giving away almost all his money by earmarking it, yet got to keep most of it until he actually transferred the shares. Nonetheless, in one stroke, he had transformed a lifetime of grasping at money by committing to letting go, and had started to disperse it by the billions. The boy who would not let his family touch the chiffer robe where he kept his hoarded coins had finally become a man who could entrust his tens of billions to someone else's hands. In the announcement speech, Buffett said, "Just over 50 years ago, last month, I sat down with 7 people who gave me $105,000 to manage in a little partnership. And those people made the judgment that I could do a better job in amassing wealth for them than they could do themselves. 50 years after that, I sat down and thought about who could do a better job dispensing the wealth than myself. It's really quite logical. People don't often have that second sit-down. They are always saying, 'Who should handle my money?' And they quite willingly turn their money over to people with a certain expertise. But they don't seem to think about doing that very often in the philanthropic world. They pick their old business cronies or whomever to administer their wealth after they're gone, at a time when they won't even be able to observe what's happening. I got very lucky, because philanthropy is harder than business. You are tackling important problems that people with intellect and money have tackled in the past and had a tough time solving. So the search for talent in philanthropy should be even more important than the search for talent in investments, where the game is not as tough." Buffett then spoke of the Ovarian Lottery. "I have been very lucky. I was born in the United States in 1930 and won the lottery the day I was born. I had terrific parents, a good education, and I was wired in a way that paid off disproportionately in this particular society. If I had been born long ago or in some other country, my particular wiring would not have paid off the way it has. But in a market system, where capital allocation wiring is important, it pays off like no other place. All along, I felt the money was just claim checks that should go back to society. I'm not an enthusiast for dynastic wealth, particularly when the alternative is 6 billion people who've got much poorer hands in life than we have getting a chance to benefit from the money. And my wife agreed with me. It was clear that Bill Gates had an outstanding mind with the right goals, focusing intensely with passion and heart on improving the lot of mankind around the world without any regard to gender, religion, color, or geography. He was just doing the most good for the most people. So when the time came to make a decision on where the money would go, it was a simple decision." The Gates Foundation followed a basic creed that Buffett shared, guided by the belief that every life has equal value. It worked to reduce inequalities and improve lives around the world in the areas of global health and education. The Gates saw themselves as conveners who brought together the best minds as advisors to work on permanent solutions to enormous problems. However much Buffett had changed and grown since Susie's death, he was still very much the same in certain ways. Alan Greenberg, who ran the Buffett Foundation, found out that the foundation he would be running would be a $6 billion foundation, not the $45 billion foundation for which he had been preparing, not from Buffett, but by proxy through Allen's new boss and ex-wife, Susie Jr. Warren had been unable to bring himself to confront Greenberg to tell him that all his plans and thinking about how to run the foundation in the future must be downsized. Susie Jr. had to convince Allen that this was in no way a grade on his performance. After his initial explosion over the fact that he hadn't heard the news from the source, he conceded that he would still be administering one of the world's 10 largest charitable coffers, and peace ultimately reigned. All involved had ample reason to behave well. Even though Buffett was giving away a vast sum, the money would be paid out over some years, and the stock he had not yet earmarked as a gift was estimated as worth more than $6 billion at the time. He still had plenty to give away. The effects of Buffett's announcement were immediate and sizable. Jackie Chan, the Hong Kong actor, announced that he would give away half his wealth. Li Ka-shing, Asia's richest man, pledged a third of his $19 billion to his own charitable foundation. Carlos Slim, the Mexican communications monopolist, ridiculed Buffett and Gates for their philanthropy, but some months later did a turnabout and announced that he too would begin giving money away. And the Gateses set up a new division within their foundation simply to handle people who wanted to make donations to them, such as a 7-year-old girl who sent the Gates Foundation her life savings of $35. The newly enriched Gates Foundation was having a tectonic impact on the philanthropic world. Its all-asset approach, which greatly resembled Buffett's ideas about concentration, and indeed his investing style, focused resources toward a short, carefully selected list of serious problems. That differed markedly from many other major foundations and community funds, at which a headquarters staff of philanthropoids circled around a series of supplicants playing eeny, meeny, miny, moe as they doled out fragmentary sums. By the end of 2006, certain organizations, such as the Rockefeller Foundation, had begun modifying their policies to align them more closely with the Gates approach. 3,000 letters from needy people poured into Buffett's office after the Gates announcement, with more coming every day. They had no insurance and were overwhelmed by medical bills, or they had gotten injured on the job and their homes were being repossessed. Their children had cataclysmic health problems that required special care, which prevented them from making enough money to pay their mortgage. Or their boyfriends had gotten them pregnant, cheated them out of money, tricked them into assuming the boyfriend's debt, and then run off without paying child support. They were the losers in the ovarian lottery. Warren forwarded the letters to his sister Doris. Over the past 10 years, her Sunshine Lady Foundation, funded with the proceeds from Howard Buffett's trust, had helped thousands of victims of domestic violence, the severely disadvantaged, and families in crisis. He enclosed $5 million with the letters to help fund Doris's work. She hired a group of women over age 50 to help sort out the letters where bad luck rather than bad choices had played a part, and relatively small amounts of money could give someone a hand up. They often gave advice to the gamblers and credit card addicts and people who just didn't want to work, but they never bailed out people who had other ways to solve their problems. And Doris never paid for everything. "I don't want to be their mommy," she said. She also made them write thank you letters. Her type of philanthropy taught gratitude and self-respect. Buffett kept handing out more of his billions. He was already giving $5 million a year to Ted Turner's Nuclear Threat Initiative, NTI, which he considered the most important of the U.S. organizations focused on dealing with the world's nuclear threat, and he was willing to give more. Former Senator Sam Nunn, who ran NTI, had proposed a nuclear fuel reserve to which countries could turn rather than developing their own nuclear enrichment programs, thereby reducing the likelihood of nuclear proliferation. Buffett felt that this idea had considerable merit, and he pledged $50 million as a matching gift if other funds could be raised. He would make huge amounts of money available to any anti-nuclear causes that seemed to him able to come up with realistic solutions to the problem. Buffett also gave a donation to former President Jimmy Carter for the work of the Carter Center. After leaving office an unpopular president, Carter had become an example of someone fallen to the 98th floor who had looked forward, not back, rising to win the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in global health, democracy, and human rights. Would love to have you join us in Ghana on February 6th through 8th, 2007, Carter wrote him back warmly after the gift, to see our guinea worm work. Buffett considered Carter a friend, but nobody, not Howie, not Big Susie, not even Bill Gates, could have gotten him on a plane to go see a guinea worm. Thus, for a third time, he avoided a trip to Africa. Some things did not change, but time moved on, and other things did change. Astrid was now Warren's official companion at events outside Omaha. She remained virtually unchanged, the same plain-spoken, unpretentious person, but her world had expanded at stunning speed. She now socialized routinely with Bill and Melinda Gates. In the fall of 2005, she and Warren had flown to Tahiti to attend Bill Gates's 50th birthday party, which took place on Paul Allen's sleek blue-and-white Octopus, one of the world's largest yachts. A billionaire's little boy fantasy that belonged to the world's sixth richest man, the Octopus had a movie theater, a recording studio, two helicopters, a 63-foot tender, and a small submarine that could sleep 8 people for 2 weeks on the ocean floor. She and Warren stayed in Paul Allen's mother's stateroom, a large suite with a walk-in closet and a library in the sitting room. "Oh, my God," says Astrid. "It was unbelievable. I have never experienced and will probably never experience a time like that again." "It beats home," was Warren's reaction. He returned from the trip talking of the onboard bridge games. 2 years after Susie's death, on his 76th birthday, Warren married Astrid in an unfussy civil ceremony at Susie Jr.'s house, with no guests other than family. Astrid wore a simple turquoise blouse and white pants, and Warren wore a business suit. Tears welled from her eyes as he placed a huge diamond solitaire ring on her finger. Afterward, they went to the Bonefish Grill next to Borsheim's for dinner. Then they flew out to San Francisco for a wedding party and a traditional wedding cake at Sharon Osbourne and David Smith's. The Gateses joined them for the celebration. Warren Buffett, the not-simple man of simple tastes, now had the simple life of the man that he had always believed himself to be. He had one wife, drove one car, occupied one house that hadn't been redecorated in years, ran one business, and spent more and more time with his family. Buffett always said that trees don't grow to the sky, but new saplings form. The question of who would succeed him had long vexed his shareholders. He sometimes quipped that Berkshire could be run by someone working 5 hours a week, or by Charlie's bust of Ben Franklin, or by a cardboard cutout. He'd also joked about controlling it after his death. "Well, my backup plan is that I figured out how to manage the company by seance." No one was fooled by his banter. On other occasions, he was just as likely to tell his listeners, "My psyche is all wrapped up in Berkshire." And those who worked for and invested in Berkshire were all wrapped up in Buffett. He was not replaceable. And what would happen to all that capital? The question of either a dividend or a huge share repurchase would arise instantly when he was gone. His successor would have to change some things, for while parts of the Berkshire model should be preserved, other parts should not. The headquarters staff, famously minuscule, would probably grow as outsourced functions were reclaimed. Meanwhile, the presumption continued to be that all of the succession candidates already worked at Berkshire. But that wasn't necessarily true. In fact, the board would be obliged to consider outside candidates when the time came. Buffett once said that he would be happy if Berkshire was still serving his shareholders 30 years after his death. That was his design. The elegant machine that he had created was built to last more than a generation beyond him. Yet to maintain it would be a remarkable accomplishment. He was the soul of that machine, and without him there would be a vacuum at the center, no matter what. For Buffett was the best there would ever be at the thing that only he could do perfectly, which was to be himself. No group of shareholders in history had ever missed their CEO as much as Berkshire shareholders would miss Buffett when he was finally gone. None had ever thought of their CEO as a teacher and a friend the way Buffett shareholders had thought of him. The man who had made billions had touched thousands of people and had a relationship that felt personal to countless others whom he'd never met or seen. But oddly enough, no matter how many fan letters Buffett got or how many autographs he signed, he never fully grasped how loved and admired he was. He got as excited about every letter and request for an autograph as though it were the first. In July 2007, the Dow hit a new high of 14,000. Then it began to fall. House prices had already peaked, the way every great bubble peaks, partly because the Federal Reserve had finally started raising interest rates, and house prices had been sliding for some time. Unable to refinance, homeowners were defaulting on their mortgages at historically high rates. The global margin call began in August. Over a period of 8 months, the financial world imploded in a credit crisis of historic proportions. Not since the Great Depression had such a severe credit seizure occurred. Not since the Panic of 1907, when old J.P. Morgan himself had personally intervened to orchestrate a solution to the panic, had such extraordinary informal intervention in financial markets taken place as would occur in 2008. The crisis progressed in fits and starts, with weeks and even months of apparent calm, followed by convulsions that left victims scattered like broken shells on a beach. As it turned out, derivatives had indeed spread risk. Banks reported tens of billions in losses. A hospital management company in Australia lost a quarter of its investment portfolio. 8 Norwegian towns lost millions on supposedly safe mortgages securities. Estimates of total losses ranged from hundreds of billions to as high as $1 trillion from all sources combined. Like long-term capital, the underlying bets were all made in the wrong direction. They had assumed a rational, efficient market in which a decline in prices would be halted by cool-tempered, calculating buyers. They said all these derivatives made the world safer and spread the risk out, but it didn't spread the risk in terms of how people reacted to a given stimulus. Now, you could argue that it might be way better to have that credit with just 5 banks who could all work than to have it with thousands around the globe, all of whom are going to rush out of it at the same time. The Federal Reserve cut interest rates once again and worked with other central banks to activate other emergency sources of financing, yet the credit crisis continued to spread. The reluctance to lend began to show signs of contagion. The Dow fell 17% to 11,740 from its October high. With each new announcement of a fire sale, bankruptcy, or collapse, the low rumbling panic grew louder. More people tried to sell assets behind the scenes and found no buyers. More lenders began to call in loans. On Thursday, March 13, 2008, a run began, this time on Bear Stearns, the weakest of the investment banks, as its lenders started refusing to roll over its loans. In a near recreation of the Solomon crisis 17 years earlier, the following day, Friday, Bear nearly collapsed from lack of financing. But this time, the Federal Reserve took the unprecedented step of guaranteeing $30 billion of Bear Stearns' debt, the first time the Federal Reserve had ever bailed out an investment bank. Bear closed at $30 per share on Friday afternoon. Buffett pondered the situation that evening. Long-term capital management's bailout had been a dress rehearsal on a much smaller scale for this moment. The speed with which fear can spread. Nobody has to have an account at Bear Stearns. Nobody has to lend the money. It's a version of what I went through at Solomon, where you were just inches away all the time from, in effect, an electronic run on the bank. Banks can't stand runs. The Federal Reserve hasn't bailed out investment banks before. And that was what I was sort of pleading back there in 1991 with Solomon. If Solomon went, who knows what kind of dominoes would set off. I don't have good answers to what the Fed should do. Some parts of the market are pretty close to paralyzed. They don't want contagion to spread to what they would regard as otherwise sound institutions. If Bear fails, and 2 minutes later people worry that Lehman fails, and 2 minutes after that they worry that Merrill will fail, then it spreads from there. The rational Buffett tried to unlock the puzzle embedded in the risky choices facing the Federal Reserve. It had no really good options. Either it allowed a financial meltdown, or it took actions that would promote inflation by adding to downward pressure on the dollar. It could all end on a dime if they flooded the system with enough liquidity, but there are consequences to doing that. If dramatic enough, the consequences would be the immediate expectation of huge inflation. A lot of things would happen that you might not like. The economy is definitely tanking. It's not my game, but if I had to bet one way or another, everybody else says a recession will be short and shallow, but I would say long and deep. You absolutely never want to be in a position where tomorrow morning you have to depend on the kindness of strangers in the financial world. I spent a lot of time thinking about that. I never want to have to come up with $1 billion tomorrow morning. Well, a billion I could, but any significant amount. Because you just can't be sure of anything. You have to think about things that have never happened before. You always want to have plenty of money around. All weekend, the regulators and bankers toiled, much as they had years earlier on Solomon. This time, however, it was with the almost certain knowledge that the bank's failure would have catastrophic consequences to the global financial system. Whether Bear Stearns deserved its fate was not at issue. Just before the Tokyo markets opened on Sunday, the Federal Reserve announced that it had orchestrated a sale of Bear to investment bank J.P. Morgan Chase for a pittance. Buffett had been offered the deal, but thought it contained too much open-ended risk. The same day that the Bear bailout was announced, the Federal Reserve, attempting to calm panic and prevent a run on Lehman Brothers, did indeed begin to flood the system with liquidity. It offered to let the largest investment banks borrow up to $200 billion at its discount window, using mortgage-backed securities as collateral. Use of the discount window, formerly a privilege restricted to commercial banks, had never before been extended to investment banks, which are not subject to the reporting and capital regulations that are quid pro quo for such borrowing. The move didn't calm the panic. Then the government made the offer open-ended. The government was going to accept bad loans as collateral. It began to take a variety of once again unprecedented steps to try to unfreeze the mortgage markets and help struggling lenders. Market pundits praised the Fed's rescue of Bear and pump priming of the investment banks as the only way to prevent contagion, but argued whether these actions would hasten an economic recovery or only prolong the pain and plant the seeds of the next bubble. And for 7 months, while these financial disasters were unfolding, the value of the dollar, which had been declining for some time, had continued to slide. Meanwhile, oil prices spiked. By July 2008, spot oil traded at $144 per barrel. It's a weird time. We've gone into a different world, and nobody knows what will happen to the world. But Charlie and I looked at the downside, and nobody else did very much. Deleveraging could be a painful process in which banks, hedge funds, financial services companies, municipalities, the construction and travel industries, consumers, and indeed the whole economy withdrew, fast and painfully, or slow and painfully, from the intoxicant of cheap debt. Asset returns could well stay subpar for a long time, what Charlie Munger called a 4% return world. Beware of scams and charlatans, said Munger. They might proliferate because the easiest way to turn 4% into 16% is thievery. In the midst of all the chaos of the spring of 2008, there sat Buffett, whose thinking about value and risk had not changed in the nearly 60 years of his career. There are always people who say that the rules have changed, but it only looks that way, he said, if the time horizon is too short. There was Buffett, stooping for cigar butts as if he were a child again. He took no joy from others' pain, but in the business of life, everyone chooses a side to play. Times like these brought out his sharpest skills, the joy of doing what he loved most, true to himself. We're selling some credit default swaps, insurance against firms going bankrupt, in situations where it is underpriced. I'm sitting here with my newest daily paper that I read, The Bond Buyer, on my lap. Who the hell would have thought that I'd be reading The Bond Buyer every day? The Bond Buyer costs $2,400 a year. I felt like asking for a daily subscription rate. We get these bid lists on failed auctions of tax-exempt money market funds and other auction rate bonds and have been just picking them off. The same fund will trade at the same time on the same day from the same dealer at interest rates of 5.4% and 8.2%, which is crazy. They're the exact same thing, and the underlying loans are perfectly good. There's no reason why it should trade at 820, but we bid 820 and we may get one, while concurrently someone else buys exactly the same issue at 540. If you told me 10 weeks ago I'd be doing this, I'd have said that's about as likely as me becoming a male stripper. We've put $4 billion into this stuff. It's the most dramatic thing I've seen in my life. If this is an efficient market, dictionaries will have to redefine efficient. Who would think that tax-exempt money market funds could become cigar butts? But the most immediate and doable opportunity is weird things in the credit market, and the biggest opportunity is in mortgages. But I don't understand them well enough, although I'm learning them so that I can understand them. And if I think I've got enough margin of safety, I'll do it. But the average person should not do it. No, stocks are the things to own over time. Productivity will increase, and stocks will increase with it. There are only a few things you can do wrong. One is to buy or sell at the wrong time. Paying high fees is the other way to get killed. The best way to avoid both of these is to buy a low-cost index fund and buy it over time. Be greedy when others are fearful, and fearful when others are greedy. But don't think you can outsmart the market. If a cross-section of American industry is going to do well over time, then why try to pick the little beauties and think you can do better? Very few people should be active investors. If there is any lesson the life of Warren Buffett has shown, it is the truth of that. Trees don't grow to the sky, but Buffett felt he could help new saplings take root. He never lost his focus on business, but as he contemplated the ideal way to spend the rest of his life, once again he was roused by the urge to preach. For some time he had been giving talks to college students around the United States, traveling to their schools, welcoming them to Omaha. He liked talking to students because they were not hardened in their habits, still young enough to take full advantage of what he said. "I packed my little snowball very early, and if I had packed it 10 years later, it would have been way different than where it stands on the hill right now. So I recommend to students that if you start out a little ahead of the game, doesn't have to be a lot, but it's so much better than starting out behind the game. And credit cards really get you behind the game." As early as 2002, feeling a sense of urgency, he had begun to pick up speed with his talks to the students. They came from MIT, Northwestern, the University of Iowa, the University of Nebraska, Wesleyan, the University of Chicago, Wayne State, Dartmouth, the University of Indiana, the University of Michigan, Notre Dame, Columbia, Yale, the University of Houston, Harvard Radcliffe, the University of Missouri, the University of Tennessee, UC Berkeley, Rice, Stanford, Iowa State, the University of Utah, Texas A&M University. Much of his message was that getting rich quick wasn't the worthiest goal in life. Ironically, it was his own competitiveness and the urge of humankind to worship the rich and famous that made his audience seek him out to hear these words. Like everything else in his life, the visits from students started to snowball. In 2008, he was crowned the richest man on earth for the first time. By then, the students were coming from Asia, from Latin America, arriving in Omaha in groups of two or three schools at a time, in packs sometimes of more than 200, sometimes on several days a month. The students who made the pilgrimage to visit the sage of Omaha got the full treatment, excepting only that Buffett did not go to their hotels in person and leave bound volumes of his annual reports for them at the front desk at 4:30 a.m. The Internet now did that job for him. They toured Rose Blumkin's Nebraska Furniture Mart and roamed the aisles of Borsheim's. Buffett met them in the office. Some days now he abandoned his gray suits and tight collars and looked relaxed in casual dress. The questions often ventured far afield from business. What is the purpose of life? Some of them wanted to know. He answered this question the same way he answered the business ones, in mathematical terms. As he had told the students at Georgia Tech when Susie was in the hospital recovering from her surgery, "The purpose of life is to be loved by as many people as possible among those you want to have love you." How should society be ordered? He told them about the ovarian lottery. "How do I find the right spouse?" "Marry up," he said. He wasn't talking about money. How do I know what is right? Follow your inner scorecard. What should I do about a career? Find something you are passionate about. I only work with people I like. If you go to work every morning with your stomach churning, you're in the wrong business. He told them about the genie. Treat your body like the only car you'll ever own. Baby that car, garage it every night, buff every dent, and change its oil every week. Then he took them out to lunch or dinner at Garat's, and everyone scarfed down salty T-bones or double hash browns at the scuffed linoleum tables, as if the genie had exempted them temporarily from his rules. As they ate, they would leap up, one after another, and jockey to have a picture taken with Warren Buffett. Someday, maybe in 40 years, their grandchildren would believe them when they claimed to have talked and sat and dined with the Oracle of Omaha. What he was teaching were the lessons that had emerged from the unfolding of his own life. In that unfolding, he admits to ambition, but he denies that there was ever a plan. He finds it hard to acknowledge his own powerful hand as the creator of the sweeping canvas that is his masterpiece. As he tells the story, a series of happy accidents built Berkshire Hathaway. A money-making machine sprang up without design. Its elegant structure of true partnership with like-minded shareholders, built on what Munger called a seamless web of deserved trust, with an investment portfolio buried inside an interlocked set of businesses whose capital could be moved at will, all of them turbocharged with float. All this had come about, he claims, simply as a reflection of his personality. The final product was a model that could be analyzed and understood, yet few did, and, for the most part, nobody coattailed it. What people paid attention to was simply how rich he was. Indeed, as much as he wanted them to study his model, Buffett sometimes inadvertently discouraged it. He also wanted people to believe that he just tap-danced into work every day and had fun. But that would be the less flattering version. The truth is this. When Warren was a little boy, fingerprinting nuns and collecting bottle caps, he had no knowledge of what he would someday become. Yet as he rode his bike through Spring Valley, flinging papers day after day, and raced through the halls of the Westchester, pulse-pounding, trying to make his deliveries on time, if you had asked him if he wanted to be the richest man on earth, with his whole heart, he would have said yes. That passion had led him to study a universe of thousands of stocks. It made him burrow into libraries and basements for records nobody else troubled to get. He sat up nights studying hundreds of thousands of numbers that would glaze anyone else's eyes. He read every word of several newspapers each morning and sucked down the Wall Street Journal like his morning Pepsi, then Coke. He dropped in on companies, spending hours talking about barrels with the woman who ran an outpost of Greif Brothers Cooperage, or auto insurance with Lorimer Davidson. He read magazines like The Progressive Grocer to learn how to stock a meat department. He stuffed the back seat of his car with Moody's manuals and ledgers on his honeymoon. He spent months reading old newspapers dating back a century to learn the cycles of business, the history of Wall Street, the history of capitalism, the history of the modern corporation. He followed the world of politics intensely and recognized how it affected business. He analyzed economic statistics until he had a deep understanding of what they signified. Since childhood, he had read every biography he could find of people he admired, looking for the lessons he could learn from their lives. He attached himself to everyone who could help him and coattailed anyone he could find who was smart. He ruled out paying attention to almost anything but business, art, literature, science, travel, architecture, so that he could focus on his passion. He defined a circle of competence to avoid making mistakes. To limit risk, he never used any significant amount of debt. He never stopped thinking about business, what made a good business, what made a bad business, how they competed, what made customers loyal to one versus another. He had an unusual way of turning problems around in his head, which gave him insights nobody else had. He developed a network of people who, for the sake of his friendship as well as his sagacity, not only helped him, but also stayed out of his way when he wanted them to. In hard times or easy, he never stopped thinking about ways to make money. And all of this energy and intensity became the motor that powered his innate intelligence, temperament, and skills. Warren Buffett was a man who loved money, a man for whom the game of collecting it ran in his veins as his lifeblood. That love kept him going, buying little stocks like National American, selling Geico to have the money to buy something cheaper, pushing at the boards of companies like Sanborn Map to do the right thing for shareholders. It had made him independent and competitive enough to want his own partnership and say no to the chance to be a junior partner running Ben Graham's old firm. It had made him tough enough to shut down Dempster's distribution center and fire Lee Diamond. It gave him the determination to break Seabury Stanton. It had tamed his impatience and made him listen when Charlie Munger insisted that they buy great businesses, even though listening to other people went against his very grain. It stiffened his will to survive the SEC investigation of Blue Chip and to break the strike at the Buffalo News. It made him an implacable acquirer. It also led him to lower his standards from time to time when his turf dried up. Yet it saved him from serious losses by keeping him from abandoning his margin of safety. Warren Buffett was a timid man who shied from confrontation and needed people to cushion him from life's rougher edges. His fears were personal, not financial. He was never timid when it came to money. His passionate yearning to be rich gave him the courage to ride his bicycle past the house with the awful dog and throw those last few newspapers in Spring Valley. It sent him to Columbia, seeking Ben Graham after Harvard turned him down. It made him put one foot in front of the other, calling on people as a prescriptionist while they rejected him over and over. It gave him the strength to return to Dale Carnegie after losing his courage the first time. It forced him through the decisions in the Salomon crisis to make his great withdrawal from the bank of reputation. It lent him the dignity to face years of almost intolerable criticism without counterattacking during the internet bubble. He had spent his life contemplating, limiting, and avoiding risk, but in the end, he was braver than he realized himself. Warren Buffett would never call himself courageous. He would cite his energy, focus, and rational temperament. Above all, he would describe himself as a teacher. All his adult life, he had sought to live up to the values instilled in him by his father. He said that Howard taught him that the how mattered more than the how much. To hold his ruthlessness in check wasn't an easy lesson for him. It helped that he was fundamentally honest and that he was possessed by the urge to preach. He deliberately limited his money, says Munger. Warren would have made a lot more money if he hadn't been carrying all those shareholders and had maintained the partnership longer, taking an override. Compounded over 33 years, the extra money would have been worth many billions, tens of billions to him. He could have bought and sold the businesses inside Berkshire Hathaway with a cold calculation of their financial return without considering how he felt about the people involved. He could have become a buyout king. He could have promoted and lent his name to all sorts of ventures. In the end, says Munger, he didn't want to do it. He was competitive, but he was never just rawly competitive with no ethics. He wanted to live life a certain way, and it gave him a public record and a public platform. And I would argue that Warren's life has worked out better this way. It was the will to share what he knew in an act of sheer generosity that made him spend months writing his annual letter to the shareholders. His joy in showmanship that made him want a mobile home at his shareholder meeting. His pixie-ish sense of fun that led him to endorse a mattress. It was his inner scorecard that made him cling to his margin of safety. It was pure love that turned him into what Munger called a learning machine. It was his handicapping skill that let him use that knowledge to figure out what the future might bring. It was his urge to preach that made him want to warn the world of dangers to come. When Warren reached his 77th birthday, he mused that he had lived one-third of the lifespan of the United States. His age weighed on him. It was getting harder for him to read all day long the way he used to, since one of his eyes was getting a little weak. So he read more efficiently. He had finally given in and agreed to wear hearing aids. His voice turned gravelly faster than it once did. He tired more easily. But his business judgment was still quick and sharp. He wished he could have the next 10 years' worth of newspapers delivered to his doorstep right now. The years ahead weren't endless, but with luck, they could be long. Trees don't grow to the sky, but he wasn't scraping the horizon yet. Another new person, another investment, another idea always waited for him. The things left to learn far exceeded what he already knew. The snowball just happens if you're in the right kind of snow, and that's what happened with me. I don't just mean compounding money, either. It's in terms of understanding the world and what kind of friends you accumulate. You get to select over time, and you've got to be the kind of person that the snow wants to attach itself to. You've got to be your own wet snow, in effect. You'd better be picking up snow as you go along, because you're not going to be getting back up to the top of the hill again. That's the way life works. The snowball he had created so carefully was enormous by now, yet his attitude toward it remained the same. However many birthdays lay ahead, he would always be astonished each time the calendar turned, and as long as he lived, he would never stop feeling like a sprout. For he wasn't looking backward to the top of the hill. It was a big world, and he was just starting out. Afterward. On October 23, 2006, Berkshire Hathaway became the first American stock to trade above $100,000 per share. By the end of 2007, BRK traded above $140,000 per share, which valued Berkshire as a company at more than $200 billion. Berkshire was the world's most respected company, according to a Barron's survey. Buffett's personal fortune exceeded $60 billion. For a decade, BRK stock had compounded at slightly over 12%, a rate that some might compare unfavorably to Buffett's early years, when he achieved an average 27% return. "Trees don't grow to the sky," he always said. As Berkshire's capital grew, the climb would get steeper. But investors in Berkshire had only gratitude for the lower returns. Those who bought an index of the market had just suffered through what the Wall Street Journal called a lost decade, in which the S&P 500 index had gone exactly nowhere, falling below its level of April 1999. Buffett's talk at Sun Valley was unfolding along the lines he had discussed. The period after the 1999 stock market bubble had burst was now the third longest stretch in the past 100 years when the market made no progress. Buffett still said that stocks are the best long-term investment as long as they were bought at the right price and for a low fee. As of early 2008, he was buying stocks, but not with great enthusiasm. Sooner or later, the market's weighing machine would catch up with its voting machine. In the meantime, he continued to mostly buy businesses. Buffett had added several new directors to the Berkshire board since Bill Gates and Charlotte Guyman. In the 2002 chairman's letter, he had invited shareholders to nominate themselves for the director position. The letters had come pouring in, and Buffett, of course, collected them. He was amused, entertained, and in a few instances impressed by the people who'd nominated themselves. Still, in the end, he had added Don Keough and Tom Murphy that year instead of a self-nominated candidate. The process had revealed, however, the highly personal, to say the least, corporate governance at Berkshire. Berkshire had agreed, in response to an SEC request, to adopt a formalized process for shareholders to nominate directors. In 2007, Berkshire added another woman, Yahoo Chief Financial Officer Susan Decker, to his board, again tilting the board demographic to a younger age. Along the way, Buffett had found that he liked the idea of advertising for people to nominate themselves for jobs. He had always preferred that people ask him for things, rather than the other way around. In his 2006 letter to shareholders, prodded by Bill Gates, he had pointed out that Lou Simpson's top-notch record was at risk if anything happened to both Simpson and himself, and advertised for a successor to Simpson. "Send in your resume," Buffett said. The number one thing he and Munger were looking for was somebody who understood risk. 700 proposals arrived from all over the world. One person explained, "I am said to be selfish and also ruthless." Various people went on at length, great length, about why they felt they were cut from the same cloth as Buffett, without giving any real qualifications for the job. And many, many people wrote saying they had no requisite experience, but wanted to be Buffett's apprentice, understudy, or protege. He collected all these letters in huge boxes in the boardroom before eventually filing them away. In the end, he chose four candidates who were already successful and managing money. They now waited in the wings. After the awkward 2004 shareholder meeting, Buffett moved the business section of the meeting to late in the afternoon in 2005. That year, and in 2006, no activists had shown up. But just before the 2007 meeting, a billboard appeared hovering over a major freeway in Omaha that said, "Will your conscience let you off on a technicality?" The question referred to a proposed resolution to force Berkshire to sell its PetroChina investment. PetroChina's parent company, Chinese National Petroleum Company, CNPC, was implicated in funding Chinese sponsorship of genocide in Darfur. While not required to put the resolution on the ballot, Buffett did so and allowed a vigorous airing of the Darfur issue at the shareholder meeting. The supervoting provisions of the A shares meant that the resolution could never pass, but Buffett cared deeply what his shareholders thought of him and the company. The question was mooted when, by the end of 2007, for reasons that he said were unrelated to the Darfur question, Buffett sold the PetroChina investment. It had cost Berkshire just under $500 million. The company netted a profit of $3.5 billion. Energy prices continued to soar afterward, and he was accused of selling too soon. Meanwhile, the shareholder meetings remained a model of decorum. More protesters had begun to arrive at the microphone, where they were greeted respectfully. Then the festival went on. Berkshire had bought a number of other new businesses. The most significant included ISCAR, a highly automated Israeli maker of metal cutting tools, in 2006, Berkshire's first acquisition of a non-U.S. company. For Fruit of the Loom, he bought Russell Athletics. He took control of Equitas, assuming the old claims of Lloyd's of London in exchange for $7 billion worth of insurance float. Berkshire also bought electronics distributor TTI. In 2007, Buffett invested in the stock of BNSF, Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad, setting off a minor frenzy for railroad stocks. One investment that Buffett did not make was in the Wall Street Journal. He had never owned stock in his favorite newspaper by 2007 when press lord Rupert Murdoch offered to buy it. Some journal editors and staffers hoped that Buffett would save the paper in the cause of quality journalism, but he would not pay a premium price for a rich man's trophy, even to become the savior of quality journalism. Long ago, in the days of the Washington Monthly, the unsentimental side of Buffett had divorced his fondness for journalism from his wallet. Nothing had changed that. In 2008, candy maker Mars Incorporated announced that it was buying William Wrigley Jr. Company for $23 billion. Buffett had agreed, through Berkshire, to lend $6.5 billion as part of the deal, in an arrangement facilitated by Byron Trott, his investment banker at Goldman Sachs. Trott had been responsible for several of Berkshire's acquisitions. He understood how Buffett thought, and Buffett said that he had Berkshire's interests at heart. "I've been conducting a 70-year taste test," Buffett said about Wrigley's. The Wrigley deal harkened back to the old days when he had refused to sell a single stick of gum to Virginia McCoubrey. Buffett's first thought after agreeing to make the loan, of course, had been to call Kelly Muchamore Braz and ask her to set aside a little space at the Berkshire meeting in case Mars and Wrigley wanted to sell some products to his shareholders. The shareholder meeting turned into a mini festival of candy and chewing gum. Attendance set a new record. 31,000 people came. Also in 2008, Berkshire had acquired Marmon, a small industrial conglomerate that made electrical components, railroad tank cars and containers, truck flatbeds, industrial equipment and materials, and the like, with revenues of $7 billion. The seller was the Pritzker family, which had decided to break up its conglomerate to settle family squabbling that had broken out after the death of Buffett's old coattailing hero, J. Pritzker, in 1999. Buffett had seen many examples of family squabbles among the rich when the patriarch died. He was comfortable that his own arrangements would prevent that. Little squabbling was going on within the Buffett family in the wake of Susie's will and the gift to the Gates Foundation. Howie and Susie Jr. were doing what they loved, farming and giving away money. Peter was in discussions with Robert Redford to bring Spirit, the Seventh Fire, to Redford's Sundance Resort as an annual summer event. He was also in talks with sponsors in Germany and in China about overseas tours of the show, and about to release his latest CD, Imaginary Kingdom. The one exception to the harmony was Buffett's adopted granddaughter, Nicole Buffett. In 2006, Nicole had participated in Jamie Johnson and Nick Curzon's documentary, The 1%, a story about the children of the rich. In the documentary, Nicole unwisely positioned herself as a spokesman for the unspoiled Buffett way of life. The documentary, which appeared shortly before Buffett's donation to the Gates Foundation, resulted in follow-up appearances on CNN, National Public Radio, and an invitation to appear on an Oprah episode about social class in America. Buffett's reaction was harsh. He had sent word to Nicole that he didn't consider her his granddaughter, and if asked, would say so. Nicole told Oprah, "It's a weird thing to be working for a very wealthy family, considering I do come from one of the wealthiest families in America." She said she was at peace with not having inherited wealth, apparently a reference to the small amounts that Susie had left her grandchildren, but added, "I do feel that it would be nice to be involved with creating things for others with that money and to be involved in it. I feel completely excluded from it." The poor little me aspect of her interview was her second mistake. Afterward, she sent Buffett a letter asking why he had disavowed her. In August 2006, he wrote back, offering her good wishes, told her that she had reason to be proud of her accomplishments, and gave her some worthwhile advice. "Positioning herself with people as a member of the Buffett family was a mistake," he wrote. "If you do so, it will become your primary identity with them. People will react to you based on that fact rather than to who you are or what you have accomplished." He also wrote, "I have not legally or emotionally adopted you as a grandchild, nor have the rest of my family adopted you as a niece or cousin. It is simply a fact that just as your mother is in no respect my daughter-in-law, her children are not my grandchildren." Despite the controlled tone of the letter, Nicole had wounded him in his most tender spot, his identity and that of his family. Otherwise, he might have thought twice about sending the letter, which backfired badly on him. Nicole may have been wrong, but she seemed sincere. Instead of reining her in, the rejection letter set her off on another round of interviews that made Buffett look like Ebenezer Scrooge. One result was a page six story in the New York Post, "Buffett to Kin, You're Fired," portraying him as taking vengeance on her for participating in the documentary. To the man who had worked so hard for a lifetime never to alienate anyone, it was a painful irony. But perhaps the story would have a happier ending someday. Buffett had been able to make up with Mrs. B. He could make up with anybody who wanted to make up with him, given enough time. By 2008, Coca-Cola's stock was up 45% from its low to $58. Profits had risen steadily under CEO Neville Isdell. He had settled the Department of Justice investigation and closed a $200 million discrimination lawsuit over racial bias. Buffett left the board in February 2006. His last Coca-Cola shareholder meeting had been another carnival of activists, but nobody had to be wrestled to the floor, and the tension was set to a lower thermostat. In 2007, Isdell had announced that he was retiring. The new CEO, Muhtar Kent, was responsible for the company's successful push into non-cola drinks, where Coca-Cola had been lagging and was strategically off course. "I always used to tell Gates that a ham sandwich could run Coca-Cola, and it was a damn good thing, too, because we had a period there a couple of years ago where, if it hadn't been that great of a business, it might not have survived." General Re, Berkshire's other problem child investment, had benefited from favorable insurance markets after September 11th. It reported the most profitable results in its history in 2007, with $2.2 billion of pre-tax operating earnings. By then, General Re had earned back the losses and restored its balance sheet to a better condition than when Buffett bought it. From $14 billion afloat at the end of 1998, a decade later, General Re had $23 billion afloat and $12.5 billion of capital. It was operating with nearly one-third fewer employees, and the company had been transformed. Since 2001, General Re had produced a 13.4% annualized return on capital, a number that would be higher, CEO Joe Brandon noted in a letter to Buffett, were it not for a number of infamous legacy issues. These included $2.3 billion of losses related to insurance and reinsurance sold in prior years, and $412 million of charges for the runoff of GenRe Securities, the company's derivatives unit. Nevertheless, General Re had escaped the fate of Salomon and overcome the stigma of its scarlet letter. Buffett was finally able to praise it and its senior managers in some depth in his 2007 shareholder letter, saying, "The luster of the company has been restored by doing first-class business in a first-class way." One large and lingering trace of General Re's former problems remained. Its last act of ignominy before the change of management in 2001 had been to create a Salomon-type scandal of its own in which it broke Buffett's rule of not losing reputation for the firm. This was the event that would, as it unfolded, adjust Buffett's perception to the new legal enforcement environment in which showing extreme contrition and cooperation produced no advantage in how a company was treated by prosecutors. Extreme contrition and cooperation were now the expected minimum standard, in part because of Salomon. Anything short of that, for a company to defend itself or its employees, for example, could be considered grounds for indictment. General Re had become entangled in legal and regulatory problems when New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer started investigating the insurance industry over finite reinsurance in 2004. Finite reinsurance has been defined in many ways, but put simply, it is a type of reinsurance used by the client mainly for financial or accounting reasons, either to bolster its capital or to improve the amount or timing of its earnings. While usually legal and sometimes legitimate, finite reinsurance has been subject to such widespread abuse that accounting rulemakers have spent decades trying to rein it in. Before working on Wall Street, I was one of those trying to rein it in as a project manager at the Financial Accounting Standards Board, the primary accounting rulemaker. I helped draft rules that specify how to account for finite reinsurance. After leaving the FASB, I became a financial analyst. While working at Paine Webber, I covered the stock of General Re at the time it was acquired by Berkshire Hathaway. I first met Warren in connection with the acquisition and subsequently began to cover Berkshire. Warren had not previously spoken with Wall Street analysts, but he made an exception for me. He told the New York Times that he liked the way I thought and wrote. In 2003, after I started working on this book, both General Re and Ajit Jain's Berkshire Re were condemned in a special investigation for selling finite reinsurance that allegedly contributed to the collapse of an Australian insurer, HIH. 2 years later, General Re was accused of fraud by insurance regulators and policyholders in connection with the failure of a Virginia medical malpractice insurer, the Reciprocal of America. While the Department of Justice investigated the allegations extensively, no charges were brought against Gen Re or any of its employees. That same year, Elliot Spitzer's investigation of the insurance industry prompted an investigation by Berkshire's law firm, Munger, Tolles & Olson, which discovered that six employees, including General Re's former CEO, Ron Ferguson, and its former chief financial officer, Elizabeth Monrad, had allegedly conspired with a customer, AIG, to aid and abet an accounting fraud. The alleged fraud was executed through a reinsurance transaction designed to deceive investors and Wall Street analysts, including me, by transferring $500 million in reserves to AIG to window dress AIG's balance sheet. In June 2005, two of the alleged conspirators, Richard Napier and John Holdsworth, plea bargained and testified for the prosecution, while five others, four senior managers from Gen Re and one from AIG, were indicted on conspiracy and fraud charges. The trial, conducted in federal court in Hartford, Connecticut in January and February 2008, was noteworthy for the prosecution's use of taped telephone conversations in which several of the defendants had repeatedly discussed the transaction in colorful terms. The defendants invoked the Buffett defense, saying that Buffett had approved the outlines of the structured transaction and was involved in setting the fee. Buffett was not charged with any wrongdoing, and prosecutors said he was not involved. General Re's CEO, Joseph Brandon, who was listed among various unindicted co-conspirators in the case, was repeatedly cited by the defendant's lawyers as having knowledge of the deal. He had cooperated with federal prosecutors without asking for immunity. General Reed Chief Operating Officer Tad Montross was also named by the defendants as having knowledge of the transaction. Neither he nor Buffett, however, was listed among the unindicted co-conspirators. None of the three men testified in the case. I was subpoenaed by the prosecution as both a fact witness and expert, and testified that I would almost certainly have not upgraded AIG to a strong buy in early 2000 had I known the company's true financial position. Under cross-examination, I testified about my acquaintance with all of the defendants. I know some of them better than others, but have always had high regard for all of them. I also testified about my relationship with Warren, that I was writing this book, and that Joe Brandon has been a close friend since 1992. I wasn't asked about Tad, but I'm also acquainted with him. In February 2008, all five defendants were convicted on all counts in the indictment. They face sentencing as this book goes to print. The potential sentences range up to life imprisonment, although the odds seem to be that the terms will be much lower than that. The convicted defendants have said that they will appeal. Currently, I am also under subpoena from former AIG CEO Hank Greenberg in a related case brought against him by the New York Attorney General's office. At this writing, Berkshire Hathaway has settled with neither the SEC nor the Department of Justice. In April 2008, General Reed's CEO, Joe Brandon, resigned to help facilitate a settlement between the company and the government authorities. Accordingly, I cannot comment further on the case at this time. Warren Buffett's personality, however, is laid out in this book. Readers should be able to form their own opinion about whether he would participate in or condone the aiding and abetting of a fraud committed by a customer of Berkshire Hathaway. Finally, New York Governor Eliot Spitzer, who launched the investigation, resigned only a month after the defendants in the AIG trial were convicted, following revelations that he patronized the prostitutes of an escort service called the Emperor's Club. This is Kirsten Potter. We hope you've enjoyed this production of The Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life, by Alice Schroeder. Published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House, Inc. Text copyright 2008 by Alice Schroeder. Production copyright 2008, Books on Tape.